I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with visual artist Fabian Williams. Fabian, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Doing very well. Glad to have some time to spend with you today. And one of the things that I admire about you and your work is that there's always a sense of play or satire with some sort of devious, sort of childlike play in your work. And I feel like you really enjoy being an artist. Talk about where that sense of play or sense of enjoyment comes in your work.
I am young at heart, and I believe that a lot of things occur to you if you approach it from a youthful perspective, you know, and youthful being not having anything written or anything certain, but like sort of exploring the what if of situations and not taking things too seriously, even when approaching serious things. And like coming from that point of view, then that allows the smart assery to take effect in the work. You know, like I like talking to my kids and you know, getting their perspective on things, and that kind of keeps me young, as well as like working with other younger artists and examining how they look at things. It's very good to stay fresh because the world changes. Now, a lot of things stay the same, yes, but there's always a current of change, and to stay on the cusp of that, to me, it's important to ride that wave as an artist, from my point of view.
So when you talk about your sort of smartassery, mm-hmm. as you call it.
I can't even say that around my mom. That's
your solo show, The Race Card, mm-hmm. I felt like was a great example of that, because there were a lot of interesting moments and conversations around that exhibit that I'm not sure that you even realized happened in and around that show. And your subjects in this particular work came from pop culture. Mm-hmm. And you sort of made some historical references to what has come before us, what has currently been in existence, but also approached it from a very smart and fun perspective. So talk about The Race Card show.
Well, I basically, it started out, man, like in 2007, I want to say. I worked at this one ad agency, and I kept running into instances, really even before that, but especially at this place, where I just kept having these run-ins with racial situations, but I couldn't really call them out because it wasn't like they said the word nigger. You know what I mean? But I was getting the nigger treatment, at least, you know, how I felt. So I wanted to have a way to address it through humor, so I could make the situation known and educate them and also make me feel better at the same time. So I came up with The Race Card after having a conversation, with some of my coworkers. And one of the coworkers slipped me this piece of paper with the R on it and Al Sharpton's face on it. And I was like, well, you know, thank you. Because it gave me the idea for The Race Card. So I went and I created these cards that I could put down when I felt like a racial situation was happening at that moment, and I could either educate that person or put them on notice. It's like a referee flag. So continuing on with that, like after I had The Race Card, I was like, well, what other things can I do to sort of examine this phenomenon of subtle racism? Because I mean, like, racism now is not like it was with our parents. You know what I'm saying? Like, you white people, or really just people in general, are smart enough to edit themselves when, you know, out in public. They may say it behind doors, but not just going to come out and, you know, label you, but they treat you a certain way. Certain situations are definitely made for you if you're a person of color. And then you also have the culture of the pop culture sort of supports these narratives. So I looked at, you know, minstrelsy and how does it apply today to certain streams of hip hop, mostly radio hip hop. And I just started taking images from the past and putting them over images of hip hop today, and they line up. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, you don't really have to say anything. You just put them next to each other and just let, you know, let the mind work it out. And that's kind of how the whole show came about. Like, really, it started off of one of my friends, Jamie Dean, who collects minstrel, what are they called? Artifacts, I guess you could say. Picking any spoons and ashtrays and postcards, Gator Baby postcards. I mean, like really, really ugly stuff that was circulating around the United States and really the South for, you know, decades, you know. So it's funny how that same sort of imagery inspires contemporary work today in hip hop. I mean, it's really sad, but it's also a way to educate, you know, those of us are still being bamboozled. You know what I mean?
But even in this race card show, I realized that you were equal opportunity.
Oh yeah.
When it came to what you were highlighting, because even in the physical race card, like you actually made a pack of race cards that depicted, I think, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, mm-hmm. Bill O'Reilly,
Rush Limbaugh.
Rush Limbaugh. So you were taking aim at all of the sort of popular figures who use race mm-hmm. as the underlying, maybe underlying foundation of their presence.
Yeah. So the way I looked at it, and I mean, the way it is, I mean, it's like racism is all about division, it, you know, divide and conquer. If people united and they look past the bullshit that we've been fed, you really realize that we sort of all want the same thing. We all want to be loved. We want to love our loved ones. We want to be respected, and we want to be able to have the opportunity to bring ourselves up to the level that we see ourselves, you know, as valuable humans. And racism, you know, seeks out the division. It seeks out the things that make that person, these people different from you, and it encourages you to separate yourself from them. So there's race baiters on the white side, which is Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, in my opinion. Those are the more prevalent ones. And, you know, we have Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton on the black side. And they have been carrying their, you know, mission since the day that Martin Luther King fell. And they've continued that legacy on. And nothing has really changed except for, you know, their position of power. You know, here it is. There really hasn't been any real fight against poverty, the war on drugs, which is the plague of the black community, you know, right now. And that's what, to me, got Martin Luther King killed. Here you have these other people that hung around him that benefited from his downfall, but have not moved the agenda forward. And then you have Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, who have made a mountain of cash off of, you know, pointing the finger at people like Rush Limbaugh. I'm pointing the finger at Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson about being race baiters, when all they do is race bait themselves. They just do it on Fox News and on Rush Limbaugh's network. You know what I'm saying? They do the same thing. The exact same thing, damn near, that, you know, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton do. It's just that they aren't called race baiters. But, you know, people support them. They buy their bullshit books and they go on their show and make their case. And, you know, they're just allowed to push the division. So I came up with these cards to sort of to sort of play those things out in real time, but sort of use it in a way to educate those people that are actively participating in the division and the bullshit.
And it was funny.
It was fun. It's fun. It is fun. It's kind of weird, actually, when you play it. I actually had a race car played on me before. You know what I'm saying? this guy played it on me one time when I was at a show at Art, Beats, and Lyrics, and he didn't know I made them. And, you know, it was like a, it was an ironic moment because it made me think about it. And, you know, like what part am I playing in the division? You know what I'm saying? Like, definitely the future of, I think, my work will be headed in is coming up with solutions. I know the point of art, a lot of, especially now, is like to ask the questions and challenge this and that. But, like, why is it a bad problem? Like, why doesn't art present solutions? You can ask questions, but is it a bad thing to, you know, present ways to solve the problem? Do you always have to ask questions? Can you, like, answer them too? And I just don't see a whole lot of that really. And, you know, when I look around and, you know, maybe it's a full-hearted, you know, attempt to do that type of thing. But, like, I feel like that's the next step. Now, I'm continuing my smart assery into the next series that I'm doing, which is called The Contraption. And The Contraption is basically Rube Goldberg machines made to diagnose conspiracies, which, you know, to me is the next phase of racism. Like, racism is, to me, a contraption. It's a conspiracy. It's like, how do you divide these people and give power to one in order to keep the other at a certain point and also take the resources and put it all in one area? So,
well, back to your point about solutions, and to shift it somewhat, but to harp on that point, I know you're big into hip hop.
Yeah.
And
when you said like I, you know, I went after everybody, I kind of modeled the approach after, you know, Ice Cube's first few albums, you know, like in Death Certificate, like, you know, he went after everybody, like nobody was safe. And like at its highest form, that's what hip hop is. Hip hop is just like straight up, no chaser. It's the truth. And, you know, in order for things to move forward, you not only have to point the finger at your, you know, your oppressor, but you have to point the finger at yourself for allowing yourself to be, you know, in these positions. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, listening to like new music, like Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly is a great example of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is what it is.
But to your point about solutions, mm-hmm. and I feel like in hip hop, there have always been artists who ask questions or to put it more differently, they lay out the conditions very well through story, through art, and they ask those questions, but maybe they have not been as forthright in the solutions part of that. What's your take on that?
There are artists. I have to think real hard on ones that give solutions, and I can't think of anybody offhand, and that's a problem. I'm sure there's somebody that could call in and give me, you know, plenty of examples, and I'm sure I know songs, but there's nothing that comes to mind that, you know, where artists was like, we should do this. I think one of the most recent was Kendrick. I hate to be a jock writer, but Kendrick Lamar did this song, like, I Love Myself. And, you know, a lot of, you know, positive progression personally starts with you loving yourself. And loving yourself is sort of difficult if you have, you know, a past that has challenged, you know, your self-esteem or your image. And who has the most negative image when they look around, you know, the community, the country, on TV, like who has the worst negative image? And you would have to say, you know, African Americans. You know what I'm saying? Like without someone pulling you to the side and be like, hey, you know, you're a great thing, you know, you're a great person, it's hard to find that externally, you know, to me. It doesn't jump out. It certainly doesn't jump out at you. So, I mean, I can't really think of anybody right now.
We'll come back to that. Songs. Yeah. So, but staying on that theme of hip hop and its importance to you, hip hop is one of those things, one of the things that influenced in some way your way to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about maybe how you even got to Atlanta and maybe what influenced your journey here.
Well, I ended up in Atlanta because fresh out of school, I was working for a startup company. My professional life has been a series of stints at startup companies and advertising agencies. So when I graduated from college, East Carolina, around 99, I got a job at this place called Helint. I worked there for like almost a year, got laid off, worked for another company in Raleigh, got laid off, and ended up coming to Atlanta because my homeboy, was like, Atlanta is like great, and there's all this stuff happening. You should check it out. And he had a couch, so I jumped in the car, packed up my stuff, and rode down to Atlanta. And part of the reason I came to Atlanta also was because of the hip-hop there, which was uniquely Southern. I'm Southern. Like, culturally, I'm Southern. I'm from North Carolina. And, you know, I love New York hip-hop, but I didn't always align with it culturally because I'm Southern. So when Outkast and Goody Mob came out, like, their way of approaching it really resonated with me. And, you know, I was like, well, there's something in the water, obviously. So, you know, when Dub was like, come down, I didn't even like challenge it. I was like, okay, I packed up my shit and I drove down to Atlanta. And when I got there, I quickly realized that Outkast and Goody Mob and Dungeon Family, that's a special group because, I mean, although there are a lot of artists that are conscious and everything here, their level of artistry and commitment to the craft was definitely not something that was common, you know. And it played a big part in the way I approached my work. So, which is why I ended up building a pyramid, a Dungeon Family pyramid.
Yeah, that was on the Beltline.
Yes, still on the Beltline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where is that piece?
It is on the 11.75 mile in Piedmont Park, close to the dog park. If you're traveling the trail and you pass by Amsterdam Cafe, if you keep going, you'll see the pyramid slightly up the road.
Okay. Yeah. Just as a point of reference, you mentioned W as in?
Dwayne Wright,
but also
Arbeats and Lyrics.
Yes, Arbeats and Lyrics.
Founder. With Jabari Graham, yeah.
Yeah, so just a bit of historical tangent there for our listeners out there. But talk about your transition also from commercial artist to independent artist, because you mentioned that you've spent a lot of time working on the commercial side for ad agencies, mm-hmm. and now you have made this intentional transition to be more focused on your art, your art as an independent artist. So talk about that transition.
I mean, advertising, you know, pays well. Coming from where I came from, my mom worked in a factory for 37 years. She's always had a job. My stepfather was in the military, always had a job. My father is a teacher, but was also in the military. So like, I come from a working class family, and they're like, you know, get the paper, keep your head down, keep the paper. And then the whole culture of an artist is to ask questions, question everything, look at everything objectively, and go against the grain, basically. So, I mean, I was always the black sheep, and working in advertising is sort of like soul crushing if you're a expressive person. Now, like advertising in itself is an art form, but you are the mouthpiece for your client, right? So clients don't always make the best decisions creatively. And after a while, it can be soul crushing, as well as the act of selling people things that they don't need. You know what I'm saying? And I have, you know, philosophical disagreements with some of the clients that I work for. And after a while, I couldn't ignore that voice in my head, you know. So instead of being 80% advertising and 20% art, I decided to make it 80% art and 20% advertising. And even now, most of the advertising I do is like spotty, which is painful on my bank. I mean, like excruciatingly painful. But I'm learning how to, you know, survive in the art world as well. And, you know, eventually I think I'll be okay, you know. But, you know, making the decision was tough because I'm used to, you know, having money, you know, like the starving artist shit is for real. But I mean, you know, it won't stay that way. And, you know, I think I'll find great success in doing what I love. And that's sort of like the, you know, my version of the American dream, if there ever was one.
But even in you detailing that journey and thinking about your art and all of the things that you've done up to this point, one of the things that I feel like gets lost, and I'm going to pay you a compliment here, because of your persona, because of sort of the mixed media that you present, I feel like you don't get as much recognition for your technical ability as an artist. Like I look at your work and you do great work. Like it's very technically proficient, but I feel like maybe that gets overlooked sometimes.
Well, thank you. That's my fault though. Like, you know, I spent 5 years doing the Worldwide Art Federation, and this is that whole time I worked in an ad agency. I was either freelance and I was working in an ad agency. So the goal of it was to eventually move out and like make my personal artwork, you know, the centerpiece of the platform. But producing the show became the art, you know? And so if you notice, if you follow the Worldwide Art Federation, the more shows that came about, the more they were like me. Like, there's this character I made called Exacto, who...
Hold on. Talk about the Worldwide Art Federation. Oh. Like, actually talk about it in its proper context.
Okay, so the Worldwide Art Federation is an experience that I created in 2009, November of 2009, where I have artists dress up in character and talk shit against each other and paint. And I'm competitive. I grew up playing basketball in high school and in college. I was a 1997 intramural champion in basketball. Straight up, my team won. Like we were called, I think, the All Stars, which kind of like eventually turned into an occasional superstar. But I like to talk shit, especially when I'm playing, and I blew out my knee few years ago, but I'm still competitive. So when I look around the art community, I look at, you know, artists that I admire, and then I'll say, you know, how can I take what they're doing and take it further? So as a way to introduce myself to the fine arts community and also bring in some life into it, because when I went out to a lot of shows, I just noticed that, you know, people looking at work, you know, they would like stare at it for a few minutes and the rest of the time they'd be talking amongst themselves. And, you know, it sort of became a thing where people came to be seen around the artwork as opposed to looking at the artwork. So I wanted to flip that and have them focus on the artists. And at the Worldwide Art Federation Art Battles, it's all about the artists. You know, it's not a party. You know what I'm saying? You can drink, but your sole purpose for being there is to look at the artists and listen to them, hear what they have to say to each other, and look at their work, because the work is developed in front of them. Then there's also a cheat piece, which is work that they get to work on at home, which they can show the true extent of their ability if they choose to. So
talk about some of the artists who have been involved.
Well, shit, I could just look at this painting that I did for Rockingwell.
Fahamu, Piku.
Yep.
Dan Flores.
Dan Flores, Maya Bailey, Jessica Scott Felder, Grace Kietza, Charlie Palmer, Michi Miko, Maurice Evans, CP the Artist, Andrew Bullery. Quite a few artists have been. Brandon Sadler. Brandon Sadler was in the first art, but that's actually who I painted against. And, I'm glad that the artist had enough faith in my vision to sort of be involved. And I've been doing it ever since. I took a year off to really focus on my solo show work, but I'm bringing it back pretty soon. And I actually think I came up with a theme this morning. Yeah.
I wonder, though, looking at your work and your approach, maybe even through life, you know, as an artist, as a personality, if you will, are you an optimist?
Yes and no. I do believe, like, we can turn any situation around, but is it likely? Probably not. You know, I don't know. It's funny. I've never thought about that. Like, I feel like I can be fairly positive, but I have my dark days. You know what I'm saying? I have my doubts and my fears, and sometimes they overwhelm you. So, but then on certain days, I feel like anything is possible, and I feel like the world is going to be okay. And, you know, I mean, I go back and forth with it. You know, I really want things to be better for my kids. You know, I don't want them to experience the stuff that we as adults are experiencing or thinking the way that we think. You know, like, I feel like our minds are, you know, just not right, you know, and that affects the way you look at things. And you try and stay positive because the way that you think does manifest the things that happen for you. You know, the universe works mentally. That's true. But keeping that perspective in light of just things that are happening is just like really draining and tough. You know, it takes a special, you know, you have to sort of do calisthenics in a way to get your mind to look at things that way. You know what I'm saying? Like, you really have to work on it. And, you know, looking back at my work, I'd like, do I really have too many happy things? I don't really paint happy, you know? And I would like to change that eventually. Like, I want to end up doing happy work, still satirical, but happy. Like happiness is what you want. You don't want to always be dealing with, you know, racism and, you know, conspiracies, man. It's draining, but that's where I am. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's happening. Like, I feel like I'm more documenting than I am, you know, anything else.
Back to hip hop, really briefly, mm-hmm. before we wrap up. You're from North Carolina.
Yep.
Why do you feel, or what were the factors involved, whatever your opinions are on this, why do you feel that Little Brother never got to a higher level, bigger platform, bigger audience in terms of Southern hip hop?
I think it's presentation, honestly, because I think about it all the time. Like, I've played the hell out of all their albums. I've been a big fan of Lil Brother since they came out, Knife Wonder and all them. You know, like Knife Wonder when he remade Nas's Godstepson. I mean, like, you know, I've been a fan since then. And then I'm proud that they're from the same area that I'm from, because I understand their plight. You know, like, you know, there's great art coming out of there. I mean, I feel like I'm proof of that, but, you know, the recognition is lacking. And, for whatever reason, man, like, you know, you have J. Cole. J. Cole's from Fayetteville, right across town. And I don't know about any songs he's done with Fonte or Big Pooh or even Ninth. You know what I'm saying? What's up with that? And I mean, part of it is like, you know, Lil Brother still viewed as an independent, you know, group. You know, they had a deal for like maybe like once, like a year or so. And that went to the wayside because it didn't get the numbers, I guess, that it needed. And, you know, I've seen them live and they have the live show was good. But there isn't this. I'm not sure what it is. It doesn't necessarily connect with the audience that is looking for a simplified expression of hip hop. You know, like hip hop, radio hip hop is really simple. You know what I'm saying? Get money, you know, lower women to, you know, almost a subhuman level and don't trust them. And whenever you can, consume drugs or sell them and repeat. You know, you're not going to get much more out of that. Oh, and if somebody has something you like, take it. What else? Kill it, Will. And don't trust anybody. Like, don't trust anybody. Like, how can you?
That's
like if you
that's
listen.
That's I mean, that's a very dark description of
radio hip hop.
Of radio hip hop.
But am I lying? You know, is it wrong? Like, that is the overall, like, there was a point at time where, and I might actually add this in the contraption show, where I count the amount of messages, those messages, and I put, like, a number every time I hear something reinforcing those messages. And it adds up. You know, like, if you listen to song after song after song after song about that thing, like, it's getting beat into your head. Like, you start to practice those narratives. You know what I'm saying? Like, it has turned into a weapon against us. You know, I can't even let my kids listen to it, really. You know, it's just bad food. And it's one thing if you have one song about that and then you had another song about this, but you don't get any of that. And the best music I've heard, I've already accepted. It will never be played on the radio.
A lot of people, to that Little Brother point again, lots of people, at least around Atlanta that I heard, would compare them to Outkast.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
And we're trying to figure out, well, this is their trajectory. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't quite, for whatever reason, maybe it was a timing thing, an industry thing, but for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And I say that in the context of what you talked about with artists who maybe were talking about things that were antithetical to what is on the radio right now.
It's like I like to use food as an example. Like, you know, there's all types of good cuisine, right? But if people are used to eating burgers and fries, and then you give them a real burger with real meat, with real toppings, that's seasoned, cooked well, to your, well, not to your liking, but like a well-prepared burger. Like comparing like a burger, I'm a big burger eater. So compare a McDonald's burger to like, say, Ann's snack bar burger. You know what I'm saying? Which isn't a very expensive burger, but it's a well done burger. You put them two against each other, and a McDonald's burger is like just not even like edible. But that's what people are used to having. That's what they're exposed to. They're not going to seek out the good stuff. Like, you know, you have to go to Ann's Snack Bar and you have to sit there. Ann's Snack Bar is like world famous ghetto burger, if, you know, to those people that live in Atlanta. You go in there, there's a process to you getting that burger. You got to sit down, you got to wait for her to call you in, then you got to go in there and like make your order, wait for it, and then get it. It's a little bit more expensive. It's a little bit harder to get, but it's way better, right? And people just aren't willing to go through that thing, that take those steps to get the good food. They'd rather just pull up, you know, pull out their $4 or $5 and get a regular old burger and get on with their day. People are just taking what is being given to them. People like myself and those that appreciate good, that have taste and better food will go out of their way to find it. You know what I'm saying? Or make it themselves. Right. So, I mean, that's kind of what you're dealing with. Like the appetite for people has changed. So they're not going to be looking for a good meal. They're just going to get what they can because they're, you know, they need to eat.
Is there an analogy to that, to art in general for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at like art that you see now, like a lot of it isn't saying anything, you know, like a lot of work that I see in the contemporary space is asking questions, but about things that I care nothing about. You know, you have all this chaos going around and like there's a very small number of people that are actually approaching it in an intellectual way. Fahamu is one of those few. You know what I'm saying? That are actually taking on those issues of black masculinity, which is a major problem in the black community, and challenging it, you know, or making people think critically about it. But, you know, I don't really go around and see a lot of street art that really, you know, deals with a lot of the things that are plaguing the society. I don't see it. And to me, historically, art is what represents the people. Like, you know, if you go back in ancient times, you find sculptures and paintings and everything. Those dealt with the psychology and the status of that group of people. Now, if American society was to end abruptly and you look at the artwork, you know, what would it say about us? You know what I'm saying? Like, what would be left in the ruins? And I think the artwork does reflect the people, but, you know, if the work isn't saying anything, then that's what the people are about. You know what I'm saying? And I can't help but look around and see that, you know, a lot of people's voices are empty. It looks good, you know, but it's not saying anything. You know, there's no voice. There's no real attempt to challenge anything. You know, just going about, you know, just making pretty shit. Damn, I said it again. Sorry. Pretty stuff. They're just making pretty paintings or pretty sculptures, but they're not really addressing anything that really needs to be talked about. And I think that's a problem. You know, you need, like, the artwork is going to influence the thinking. And if the artwork isn't saying anything, isn't, like, critical of anything, then the people are not going to respond to it either. They may consume it, but they won't. It won't have any nutritional value, right?
Is there mentorship in the arts community?
Oh, yeah.
And I ask that from the standpoint of younger artists, more established artists, thinking about their voice and what they are saying. What are those experiences like when someone like yourself or someone like Fahamu may attempt to mentor one of these younger artists in terms of maybe developing their voice as an artist?
It happens now. Like, I mean, I have to give credit to Fahamu for helping me, to refine my work. Also, Radcliffe has, you know, pulled me aside and given me some. Radcliffe Bailey has, mm-hmm, like, you know, invited me to his house, and he's, you know, guided me in ways that I could, you know, further refine my voice. And I have an assistant named Tyler Rainey who helps me with my work, and I also try and help him fine tune, you know, his expression. And, you know, you have artists like Maya Bailey who has mentored a whole staff of artists. You know, like, he's a tattoo artist / painter / entrepreneur that is producing tattoo artists / artists slash entrepreneurs. Like, you know, Corey Davis is, you know, is developing his artistry in his own right. And he came up under Maya Bailey. Paper Frank, who was about to be like, he's a rock star. And Maya is really responsible for his development. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, he's a commendable dude. So now he has a whole slew of artists coming up from under him. Was Heartless Melvin or something like that? I would have to look at the Tukey. Well, Tukey started out with Maya, but all those guys help mentor the younger artists, and they're growing, you know. And also Maya's about to open up an art gallery in conjunction with Nelson Street Gallery pretty soon, and that's going to be a big thing, you know. I think one of the first artists is Hebrew Brantley, and Hebrew is like doing really well right now. But I remember when he was walking around here as well, you know, selling shirts and doing his paintings, and, you know, now he's doing quite well. So, you know, definitely each one teach one is in effect, and it's definitely needed in order for a healthy art movement to flourish. And I really feel like it's happening right now. Like, I really feel like where New York was in the 1980s with punk and hip hop kind of coming together, like, it's happening, but it's happening in the art scene, and it's going to get real interesting in the next few years, I think, here. And I definitely want to help see that, you know, flourish to its full potential. So, yeah.
Fabian Williams, let all of our listeners know how they can find out more about you and your work.
Well, if you're inclined to do so, go to occasionalsuperstar.com. That's my website. Follow me on Instagram at Occasional Superstar, or on Facebook at Occasional Superstar, and on Twitter at Fabianism. And be on I have a show right now at the Rialto called Rocking Well, which is my work inspired by Norman Rockwell, which is like one of my biggest influences. And I have a show coming up after this called The Contraption, which is going to be a combination of all the things that I have been influenced by and yet am trying to define through conspiracies. So, yeah, I think that's it.
Fabian, thank you.
Thank you, Floyd.
Thank you for your time.
No problem.